Hello and welcome to Masters of Our Domain, the podcast which was once about the hit 90s sitcom Seinfeld, but is now about the classical world and adjacent materials. I am Milo Edwards, and I'm joined as ever by my co-host Patrick Wyman, Phoebe Roy. I couldn't decide which order to say your names in, and we almost got Patrick Roy and Phoebe Wyman there.
That's a mind fuck, man. I don't know if I could deal with gender swapping at this time of the day.
Throwing you into the machine from The Fly.
Now, if it's a little later in the day, on the other hand, yeah, let's fucking go.
Yeah, no, I mean, it really depends on my exposure to various kinds of mind-altering substances. Like, the more of those I have, the more I'd be open to considering the options.
Yeah, yeah. We've been slowly spiking Patrick with estradiol in his weed pen. And it's
I knew that Benjamin tasted different. I knew it. You got me.
Yeah, yeah. And that voice that you've been hearing is none other than Josh Boorman from The Worst of All Possible Worlds. How are you doing?
That is so true. That is me. I'm doing all right, Milo. We're hanging out here. Well, I've been in London now for a few days. Jet lag is still kicking my ass, but I'm doing what I always do when I come here, which is record way too many podcasts. So I'm excited to do it again.
Yeah, you're here on business.
That's right.
Yeah.
So are you? Would you say you're standing on business?
Period, son.
I mean, I feel like the benefit to being jet lagged in London in the winter is that you can't really tell when it's day or night anyway. So takes a little bit of the edge off.
It's actually been pretty sunny here so far.
Really?
Relatively speaking, yeah.
Yeah, it was sunny today.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was sunny any other day, but I can't remember. Yeah, I mean, well, actually, last night we were watching the new Day of the Jackal series, and every time it, because it keeps cutting between like Europe and London, and every time it cuts to London, you get like a kind of drone shot, like London skyline thing. Yeah. And every time there's like mist, there's like two story high mist, and I'm like, what do these people think London is like? Just constant, like, can't see your hand in front of your face, fucking fog.
What do they think this is? Fucking Seattle? Come on.
It's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. This, well, you know what it is. They've just gotten slightly mixed up with the Slow Horses universe in which Gary Oldman just farts constantly. Mm. So that's the mist. It's actually just flatulence from Gary Oldman.
I also just wanted to point out then when I said period, son, to Patrick, Phoebe had the wildest reaction. This is the thing, is like, I feel we were before we got rolling, we were really vibing, Patrick. We were talking about like various United States related things. We've fully hijacked this podcast now. We've Yankee-fied it. I feel good about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Look, it's not, I'm not saying that you guys need some culture, but you see, I knew as soon as I said that, Phoebe, that Phoebe was going to make exactly the face she just made. Look, I you can't help it that the United States is the home of all these wonderful forms of culture, like giant trucks, Botoxed MILFs.
Yes.
This is like, we're really, not to bring it back around to one of my core interests, but
we have Botoxed MILFs here.
Not like this, you don't.
We just have regular sized trucks.
That's no, you don't. Those aren't trucks, Phoebe.
It's Botoxed MILF has got to squeeze her silicon bazongas into a regular sized truck, like some kind of animal.
You're describing what I see dropping off my children every morning. Is almost exactly that. Like,
you're like Odysseus, like tied to the car with like wax in your ears.
Hell,
you
know, yeah.
Pretty much, yeah. I can't explain to you the absurdity of an American school drop-off, like an American private school kids drop-off. You're gonna see some shit.
So we're not here to talk about that, though. We're not here to talk about the
Botoxed MILFs.
Or other American ephemera. We are, in fact, here to talk about, I guess, something which is, in a way, American ephemera.
It certainly
I was going to say, surely there is some argument that the whole of ancient Rome is American ephemera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, ancient Rome. Oh, I was thinking the film Gladiator specifically is a remarkable piece of American
ephemera. You know what? I'm gonna dig in on the frankly preposterous statement that I just made.
Let's hear it.
Okay.
Let's hear it.
I'm gonna repeat it.
All right, go on.
American ephemera.
Great.
The original America. America Part 1. America beta testing.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah.
Well, because America is nothing if not a collection of city states, right? I mean, that's kind of what we were talking about before we started rolling, that like, I can be like,
okay, so the Delian League is American ephemera. That's what we're getting to.
I don't know. Look, I'm just going to say like, oh, I'm a New Yorker, right? Oh, they don't really understand me down in Chicago because I'm a New Yorker, right? Like,
the United States is a much better analog for ancient Rome than any modern European nation state is, because like the United States essentially exists as an army and then a couple of kind of loose centralizing institutions that mostly serve to put local elites from different parts of the country in contact with one another.
And then
a highly romanticized but disconnected from reality rural surrounds.
Yes. Mm-hmm. This is like, if you've never traveled through the United States, it's hard to overstate how little the rural areas A, resemble one another, but B, have anything to do with the metro areas. Like it is genuinely multiple different countries within, you don't even have to go that far to get into multiple different countries. And sometimes literal different countries when you, like I live not that far from the Navajo Nation, which is a different country. Like,
right.
And I think that if you're trying to understand how the Roman Empire actually functioned, that's relatively, that's not the worst analog that you could go for, where you have elites who all kind of share common ideas and common culture and some common cultural characteristics. And then a vast mass of people who speak different languages, who don't really participate in the political process in any meaningful way, and mostly consume entertainment from the center.
I was pretty surprised because I'd never actually watched Gladiator before now. Mm-hmm. And I was surprised at the extent to which it actually is, I can't tell to what extent intentionally, but certainly is serving as a commentary on the United States. And I'm sure we'll talk about that more, but I did notice that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Phoebe, you're at the treating this as a commentary on like late 90s, early aughts America is absolutely not the wrong way to go in making sense of Gladiator. It's very much a post Francis Fukuyama end of history kind of way of understanding the world.
But a pre 9/11 way of understanding it too.
Very important. Mm. Very important distinction.
Yeah, that's right. It's in like, it's in the sort of 9 years where history had ended before it started again.
Also represent, it has a lot more in common with like Air Force One and other
get
kind
off
of
my plane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Seriously. It has a lot more in common with that than it does kind of post 9/11 culture.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean the Harrison Ford Gladiator movie, the thing that never was.
Or kind of along those that same line, like Clear and Present Danger, Patriot Games, like I think those are leaving aside the historical trappings of Gladiator, those are the kind of thematically the
Independence Day would be another one.
Oh God, yeah, Independence Day, great example. Yeah.
Roland Emmerich kind of working in the Ridley Scott register in that one.
Independence Day is a perfect example of it because for almost 30 years afterwards, there will never be another film with the specific imagery that is in Independence Day because of what it looks like.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
They didn't blow up the World Trade Center, though. They blew up the Capitol Records building in the White House. It's fine.
Have you not seen the deleted scenes of Independence Day?
Oh, did they blow up the World Trade Center?
No. Come on. Come on, guys.
Okay, I thought we were about to get
on the top. Yeah, Limp Bizkit were obliterated in the Independence Day universe.
I want this Limp Bizkit obliterated. Is this anything?
Yeah. Yeah, maybe.
I don't know. I kind of feel that if we were visited by hostile extraterrestrials, I feel like they would not necessarily find common cause with Fred Durst, but I think they might want to hear him out.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because they'd be like, well, this guy's banned from Ukraine. Yeah. I'm interested.
What?
He's banned from Ukraine.
Are we talking?
He was also raised as a witch.
Are we talking?
Fred Durst was?
Yeah.
That can't be
the Durst
true.
Witch.
There's no way. There's no way that's true.
That is absolutely true. Look, you know what?
Phoebe's falling foul of her own problem here, which is that she's so deadpan and she's told so many lies before. No one believes that.
You were just talking about deleted scenes from Independence Day blowing up the fucking World Trade Center. Now,
there's nothing about that that isn't believable. I could totally see a scene getting cut for time or other reasons where they blew up the World Trade Center.
But that's what works as a good lying riff.
It's just a lie. And it's just a believable one.
Just to add something to what Milo said, I only lie for humor. I'm not pathological.
No.
I'm not like that one kid whose grandma was the only woman in recorded history with hemophilia. I'm not that guy. I'm not the lying kid.
No. Phoebe's only pathological in respect to herself. Like, there's no way she's not prepared to sabotage herself in the service of a good bit.
Yeah, that's true. But unfortunately, it is true that Fred Durst was raised as a witch.
That's crazy.
There you go. Would I lie to you pressing the big button? True. Fred Durst was raised as a witch.
So if we're talking about, I just want to come back to the Fred Durst meeting extraterrestrial trills thing real quick.
Before we
move on.
It's important that we circle back to that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Are we talking like late 90s Fred Durst or 2024, 2025 Fred Durst meeting the aliens?
Oh, this is so interesting. I think we're thinking late 90s. And the reason I'm thinking that is because, and not a lot of people know this, We've not managed to make contact with extraterrestrials. That's not something that's ever been possible. Right?
You were gonna say we've not managed to make contact with Fred Durst.
Well, I mean, you know what? Once upon a time, but now he has stopped responding to my emails. he did not care for some of my lyric suggestions.
I did attend a concert at which Fred Durst got beer bottles thrown at him. This was the Summer Sanitarium tour in 2003.
Nice.
Metallica, Linkin Park, Deftones, Limp Bizkit. It was pretty great.
Damn.
It was a real slice of the times in the summer of 2003.
In the end, it doesn't really matter.
That's what Chester Bennington said, man. Yeah. Oh, too soon.
All right.
Too soon on
R.
that
R.
one.
R.I.P. R.I.P.
Yeah. No, I love Chester Bennington. That one hurt to say. I'm not gonna lie.
Chester Bennington is the sort of name that a teddy bear would have, and
probably like Paddington's brother.
Yeah. Like a guy he's somewhere adjacent to a marmalade sandwich.
Yeah.
My son, speaking of Paddington, my son tried to watch the Paddington movie where there's an earthquake and refused to continue. And he's like, no, this is too scary. I'm like,
Goes to Japan.
I'm like, it's Paddington, man. But like, we can get through this. I promise you. He's like, I don't want to. I'm done. I'm out. No more Paddington.
I think it's scary movies.
It's very Wyman to have raised a child who is scared of tectonic plates. Nothing else.
Yeah.
Oh, you're
terrified
saying
of tectonic plates. The sea people.
You grew up on the West Coast. You have a healthy fear of the tectonic plates.
That's
makes
true.
Sense.
I have been in many earthquakes in my life, and they are fucking terrifying. Like you say this, I literally did explain tectonic plates to my children the other day. And I
experienced
my
first.
Your son was just like, absolutely not. No, this is where I draw the line. Tectonic plates, fuck this.
I experienced my first honest to goodness earthquake a couple months ago. Like, New York City got its first real earthquake in a very long time. And by real earthquake, I mean like it felt like the building was under construction. Like, it wasn't like an earthquake, but for the East Coast, it was quite a bit. And I mean, even that shit was scary, and it wasn't even a real earthquake by West Coast standards. So I get it. I do.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
So we're not here to talk about earthquakes.
Oh, okay.
We are here.
Are you sure?
We are wrestling back control of the podcast in the way that I hate to do.
Sorry.
How does it feel to be the one having to do that?
I'm so sorry.
We are here to talk about Gladiator, the 2000 film by Ridley Scott with none other than Russell Bloody Crowe. We had a running bit about how Gladiator's a better movie if you just quote the Russell Crowe lines in an Australian accent. Like, you just go full on father to a murdered son, husband to a murdered wife.
He's just in that register the entire time, too. Yep.
Yeah, that's the only voice that he does.
So, you know what really fucks with my head? When I was looking at Wikipedia for this, Russell Crowe was like 33 in this movie.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
That you don't think he looks? You don't think? I always figured he was substantially older than that. And
he does have a more kind of mature look.
Well, he's got the look of someone who aged at one of the few actors who has aged at a normal pace.
Yeah.
Like a guy who actually looks like he's 57 or whatever he is now. Like,
yeah, they just didn't put him on the substance, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he's Australian. He loves drinking and smoking.
Yeah. And fighting and didn't he throw a phone at someone in a hotel lobby at one point? Like,
probably. I respect that. The old Naomi Campbell.
Yeah. That's icon. A true icon of early 2000s culture.
Yeah. And so also, I mean, rare for the movies that we review on this show, because this is a real classic. Budget of 103 million, box office of 465.
I'm honestly surprised it isn't more than that.
Domestic only?
I don't know.
Let me look it up. No, that is the worldwide gross. Domestic was 187 million, worldwide is 465. So there you go.
Really?
Numbers Ford Coppola can only dream of.
Can we? I want to put a moratorium on anything other than mocking references to Megalopolis. Like, it can't just come up. It has to be tied into a bit. Otherwise I cannot think even bring myself to think about that movie anymore.
Sure. Yeah, that's fine. And so, I mean, this movie, it's a difficult one to talk about. I mean, we were kind of riffing about this a little bit before we got started, because it's so like seminal in the most generic sense of the word. Like, when I first watched it, I was like 7.
Mm-hmm.
So it's almost impossible for me to be objective about. I've seen it so many times. It's ingrained. It's in the fabric of society at this point.
Well, and especially I think American society, it's definitely one of those that everybody knows of, even if they don't know it. Like, obviously I have seen the clip of Joaquin Phoenix like putting his thumb out and then putting it down, you know, and I've seen the clip of Russell Crowe being like, "Are you not entertained?" But beyond that, I didn't really know anything about it because I had never seen it myself. And as it turns out, it really is a pretty formulaic, like, hero's journey kind of movie. There's not much going on that's particularly surprising. The good guys are very, very good. The bad guys are very, very bad. There is really no nuance at all, either in terms of plot or character development. And it's kind of fun to have a movie like that every once in a while.
Good old-fashioned movies.
Yeah. Well, you say that, but there is the deleted scene where the Spaniard is reading Fukuyama's End of History.
Mm.
And then he slams it shut and says, "That's bloody rubbish."
Yeah. Well, that scene where he's died and he's just like his fingers along the shelves in like Brookstone or whatever, like all the books, you know, he's
still
like
fucking happening.
All the copies of Fukuyama,
all the Thomas Friedman books.
He's like going into like his local kind of pantry and just kind of running his hands through the sacks full of grain.
So
a fun thing about Gladiator, which I said to Milo and Pat in the chat, but I will tell Josh this for the first time, which was, bearing in mind that this film came out when I was a teenager, so it was, you know, it's a great and terrific fanfare. I then went on to study ancient history. I have ruined many a social occasion by bringing up what I think is wrong with the historical aspects of the film Gladiator. So imagine my surprise when watching it to prepare for this show. I've not seen it. I've not seen this fucking movie.
Okay.
What I have seen is I have seen precisely 4 2-minute segments, and then my brain, like a kind of beta testing ChatGPT, has just filled in the rest.
How?
And honestly, I didn't do too bad a job.
Right.
Yeah, I was gonna say, how accurate were you?
I didn't do too bad a job. The bit that I had an issue with was I thought that he, you know, the line, the, you know, the I am Russell Crowe. I've been to the shops this morning, and then this afternoon I plan to kick back with a beer, maybe go to the beach. I don't know. Maybe do some surfing. Husband to a murdered wife. I will have my vengeance as soon as I've had another beer.
Very Australian.
Cracks a can of Foster's.
Yeah.
Throws a shrimp on the Barbie.
Dreamer of an ice cold scooter.
Yeah. Like, yeah. plays an impenetrable game of football. And
but not the football you'd expect.
Yeah.
But not the football you'd expect.
Bowler of a wicked spinner. And I'll have my ute.
It would be really, really good if he did like everything in like kind of Aussie abbreviations as well. So like the Colosseums, the Collie.
Yeah. The Gladiator.
Commodus is M.
Yeah,
Empo.
Would be the RCG, the Rome Coliseum ground.
Look at this guy.
They love an acronym.
I just want to thank the children's television show Bluey for making me so much more familiar with Australian slang and cultural mores, so that I can now fully appreciate Russell Crowe in context. This is
Bluey is what Australians call depression.
I will say though, like the point of cultural mores, the one thing that's really jarring to me about how Australian Bluey is that they're always like calling people cunts, and I'm like, in a kids show, it's a bit much.
It's a cute cunt. So I didn't do too bad a job, but the biggest misunderstanding that I'd come away with, and like I said, I am not exaggerating the number of people I have insisted on ruining the experience of Gladiator for, and this is based on, like I said, like having seen 8 minutes of it.
So how do you feel about that now? Well, are you guilty? Are you proud?
Proud.
Okay.
I'm proud. I'm proud of that. I make no bones about it.
You gestalted a whole movie and then also criticized what you imagined, which is perfect.
Which is a perfect.
You're a closed system. There's no input, perfect, no output.
Perfect mode of cultural criticism. Yeah, I am. I am both Ebert and Roger. That's who I am. Huh.
You're watching movies. Yeah, pathetic. I'm imagining them.
I am. I am the movies.
Patrick, had you also like seen this movie a bunch of times?
I've seen it probably 25 times. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Exactly. Like,
it's one of my favorite movies.
Really?
I thought that the line that he says, I thought this was like his catchphrase. I thought he said this literally every time he puts on his little costume and picks up his little sword. And I thought that the reason that like that Commodus looks so pissed off all the time is because he's like, do not say it. Do not fucking say it. He's saying it again. It takes ages. So that's what I thought, like.
Answer phone when you get through to the voicemail is
you're through to
Maximus Decimus Meridius, commander of the armies of the north.
Or it's like his DJ text, this is a Maximus classic, commander of the north. Blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. Or believe it or not, answer phone message also.
It is pretty formulaic.
The origin story of the show.
Is that a bad thing? I mean, there's formulaic can be bad, right? If it's kind of asinine, or formulaic can be just fine in something where the actual plot is not so much the point, where the point is spectacle and the themes. Don't get me wrong, the themes are quite asinine in some fundamental way. Like, this is not a movie that is thinking especially deeply about ancient Rome or anything along those lines. But the plot is, and this is often true of Ridley Scott movies, the plot is not really the point. The plot's fairly straightforward. It's all the other stuff.
With the exception of Alien, which is, for my money, one of the greatest movies ever made.
Yeah, Alien the exception. I mean, but even like The Duelists, which is widely regarded as one of Ridley Scott's classics, love that movie, is basically the Family Guy bit about Peter fighting the giant chicken over and over. That's basically the plot of The Duelists.
I will say, I mean, to answer your question from my perspective, I don't mind a genre flick, but there are, for me, there are types of genres that resonate and there are types that don't. I love a space epic personally. Anything in sci-fi, from space opera to like hard sci-fi, is generally going to get me on side, whereas like old school swords and sandals shit is not so much for me. So I think I didn't have the same reaction. I didn't come away from this being like, oh wow, I fucking love this. But I do love some of the performances, particularly Joaquin Phoenix.
Incredible.
He is going so unbelievably hard in making so many strong choices at every turn. And I think honestly, for me, he holds the movie together.
Well, it goes to show how strong performances in an otherwise kind of mediocre movie can make it an iconic thing. Yeah. Where, like, because that's 100% the case. Like, Russell Crowe and Joaquin Phoenix are outstanding. And whenever they're on the screen together, this movie just fucking hums. And it's the supporting characters that are really the problem.
Well, the thing is, this is a genre movie, but the genre is not Sword and Sandals. The genre is Dudes Rock.
Right? Well, that's true.
It's a movie that is entirely, it's like, it's the same movie as Top Gun, but just in set in ancient Rome. It's the same, it's exactly the same vibes, you know, except Maverick dies instead of Goose. But that's the, it's more or less the same movie.
Like, kind of, but like, you've also got the Revenge Redemption arc, which is not Top Gun. Mm. That's not very Top Gun.
That is true. Yeah, they're only avenging themselves on communism.
Yeah.
And what it did.
But communism took so many lives from us. So.
Yeah. This is 2000 Top Gun, where the Soviet Union is no longer a threat. They have to, you know, create a sort of a weird camp sun to be a threat again.
The obvious parallel is Braveheart. That's the clear thing, which also is essentially a Sword and Sandals type of movie, just kind of skinned in, you know, medieval Scotland. Like, there's there's, so this was, I guess the question then is,
War and Woad.
what was it about this particular period of time that created movies like this? Because Gladiator 2, which we'll talk about at some point, has a much more cynical view of Rome than and empire in general than the original Gladiator movie does. Like, is at the core of the original Gladiator is like, Rome's not bad if you've got good guys in charge. Like, we can do some good stuff here. And the Gladiator 2 is much more ambivalent about that kind of fundamental approach to what Rome was. So, like, but that's very late 90s. It's like, well, an empire is good if it's run by good guys.
Right.
Very pre-9/11 kind of thing.
Well, and it's interesting too, because, and this is the sort of thing too, where if we were talking about this on the worst of all possible worlds, we would now delve into like a 30-minute sidebar about like something specific to do with, we would find like an article about by Ridley Scott talking about his political philosophy or some shit like that. But I think if I had to distill down what I think Ridley Scott thinks the point of this is supposed to be politically, it's not just that things are good in terms of institutions so long as the good guys control them. I think it's also that there is something inherently virtuous about a political society in which the common man has a say, but not the final say. You can see this sort of in the depiction of the Senate, where like all of the guys who are in the Senate are weenies, but at the end of the day, it's better that they are the ones who are doing it than the literal hooting and hollering mobs, who we really only see in these wide composite shots where they're, you know, screaming and very clearly baited into just the very base violence of the human spirit or whatever.
Yeah, real fundamental distrust of the people as a thing in this movie.
Yeah. Well, you know, in the Roman Empire, you know, the Senate are the Democrats and the Emperor is Trump. He's like, I hate my son. Okay, I hate my son. I hate the Democrats, but I hate my son even more. He's very bad. He's going to be a very bad emperor. You, Marcus, you're a great guy. You're a very big guy, strong guy. You're going to be in charge instead of my son. He's going to say, oh, please let me be emperor. You're going to say no. You can't do it. Why don't you go off and play?
I'm going to laugh my ass off if in 2,000 years people are talking about the art of the deal the same way they talk about meditations now. Like, if there's just a coterie of absolute dipshits on the internet or whatever the 2,000 years from now equivalent of the internet is, who idolize that shit. Like,
I mean, God, he's probably is your most published president of modern years.
The silver lining is I'm not going to be around to see it.
Just thank God I'll be dead. Immortality is not for me. I don't want to be around to see that.
Yeah, 2,000 years when there's limited sources. They're like, well, we can only assume that Trump was the best president because he's the only one who's known to have written several books. He must have been thought of as a great thinker.
I cannot wait for the doctoral dissertation on the brilliance of the on the brilliance of the philosophy of the art of the deal that comes out of that in 2000 years.
Yeah, yeah. Just he makes regular mention of this woman, Kathy Ireland, who is not, she's not seen in almost any other sources.
It's been painstakingly copied by hand hundreds of times down the centuries, you know, tattered manuscripts of the art of the deal.
I love the idea, Pat, that you like, you acknowledge there might not be such a thing as the internet, but like doctoral defenses, like doctoral theses, like postgraduate study, that's sticking around.
Yeah. Absolutely.
That one is sticking around.
100%. The world will always need graduate students.
That is
literally the motto of every single university's finance department.
It really is. Well, that's, you see, we've talked about a lot of bleak stuff on this podcast. Mm-hmm. That's maybe the bleakest one.
Yeah. What are 25-year-olds going to do? Get a job? Don't make me laugh.
I mean, that's the thing about the podcast, right? It's always so funny right up until it gets real. And then,
that's,
I mean,
right.
I totally agree with what you're saying, but I actually think it's more explicit than that. I think it's like, it's less kind of skirting around the mob is bad and institutions are good as long as they got good guys in charge. Like it's stated explicitly, but what is like Crow, whose name I have forgotten in it.
Maximus.
What's his name?
Maximus Decimus Meridius.
I'm not
father to a murdered son.
I'm not going to say. I think of him as Russell Crowe.
The Spaniard. I'm going to call him the Spaniard. Okay. That's like his nickname. It's cute. It feels like I know him.
Because he goes for a little sleep after the fight.
I've got a parasocial relationship with him because, you know, they showed him like, you know, eating with the other gladiators, and he's like, do you have any smaller plates?
Yeah, could we have more of a selection of picky bits?
I just want a little. Have you got any little deep fried artichoke leaves? I love those. He says there was a dream that was Rome. This is something that like that is explicitly stated. It's one of his lines. And when there is some guy, and I lost the thread of who we were supposed to be, but there is some guy who is talking about Commodus and the games he's going to put on. And he's like, oh, yeah, no, Commodus will give the people death and they will love him for it. They are explicit, the Roman people.
Is that Derek Jacobi who says that?
Yeah. The Roman people are kind of like blood-soaked, hollering apes and like the kind of the dream of Rome. But what is so weird about the dream of Rome as put across by Marcus Aurelius? Now, when I was 20 and I lied to people to say that I had seen the film Gladiator.
Thankfully, you don't lie to people anymore.
No.
You've grown out of ruining movies you haven't seen for people.
Look, deadpanning is not lying.
Honor, I wasn't lying. I was merely deadpanning.
If we've established anything over the course of today's show, it's that. Yeah.
Do you swear to tell the whole truth, nothing but the truth to help you, God? Yes.
As long as it doesn't involve discommitting from the bit.
Yeah. Yeah. Calibrating a lie detector with Phoebe. You've got to get her to say something that's true but sounds like a lie, like Margaret Thatcher invented soft serve ice cream.
In order to
get the machine to work.
She did invent soft serve ice cream. This is to date one of the severest rows that me and Milo have ever had. Because he would not believe me.
Is it actually
was
true?
Too. Yeah, you were getting really furious because we were both like, yeah, fuck off, Phoebe. And we were on a pier at like a mile and a half into the sea. So we couldn't, she couldn't Google it and prove this right. And she was getting really indignant. And we were like, yeah, but you always do that when you're on the wind up. So
is it actually true?
It is true. Yeah.
That's not what I'm seeing. I'm fact checking this right now. And the number one result is an article from the New Yorker that's called The Margaret Thatcher Soft Serve Myth.
It's not a myth. She was on the team. She didn't like do it herself. She didn't like sit down and be like, oh, this, you know.
Look at Phoebe over here just endorsing the great man theory of history. Like just erasing the contributions of others in favor of putting Margaret Thatcher up there. That's
uncritical. This is problematic.
Didn't know we were running into a Thatcherite.
Look. All right. All I'm saying is I am working on an Oscar bait script. It's called Whippy. It's about Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah, it follows her from when she didn't get into art school directly up the timeline to when she invents soft serve ice cream.
I'm just going to go ahead and say this right now because I need to stand up for the United States, the greatest country in the history of the world, and point out here that in this article it says, for starters, most sources agree that the soft serve industry arose in the United States, not Britain, in that it preceded Thatcher's arrival at Jay Lyons by about a decade.
Ooh. Are you, what are you trying to fucking Rosalind Franklin soft serve? Don't do
USA,
that.
USA. USA. Come on, Patrick. USA.
Is there anything more American than a product that is kind of like what it purports to be, but isn't actually? That's that seems pretty American to me.
I can't believe it's not butter.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Pasteurized cheese product, man. That's American. Right. That's American right there.
Also invented by Margaret Thatcher.
Yeah, that's right. So yeah, Margaret Thatcher is like a hidden figures lady, but for soft serve ice cream, her importance from history is being erased.
I want her played by Taraji P. Henson in the biopic. That's what I want.
And it's going to be a troubling performance, but she's going to...
She's gonna make it work.
So what I objected to in the 2 minute segment that I saw, which is just before Marcus Aurelius dies, he says, I'm gonna bring back the Republic. Now, okay. First of all, I am not expecting him to say, and when I say I'm gonna bring back the Republic, what I mean is the very, very specific bureaucratic arrangements around which not just the Republic, but a very specific and quite short period of time in the Republic, in the period which is loosely termed the Republic, that we can point to, which is a very, very specific set of political and economic contexts, which were entirely dismantled by a mixture of decades of political unrest and imperial expansion, like the expansion period of Rome was not the Roman Empire. There's this kind of weird idea kind of put forward in this film that like there was the Roman Republic and it was Rome and then it had the surrounding lovely farms and then there was the Empire and then they started expanding and then they got decadent and, you know, and decay, etc.
Yeah, well, if you watch the director's cut, he does say all of that, but they did cut it in the cinematic release for time.
Well, the problem is because the Spaniard keeps lapsing into Australian slang, so he keeps calling it things like the Middle Republo and the Punic Warzo.
Easy to see how that would be confusing.
The issue is that those guys, they were just called the Skippy, and they were just renamed by an Australian historian. So that's why we think they're the Scipio. And that's even weirder because you'd think that an Australian historian would be familiar with things called Skippy.
I'm starting to believe, I'm getting the weirdest feeling that I can't trust what you're saying right now.
Well, okay.
What's you can trust what I'm saying about the bureaucratic arrangements of the end of the Roman Republic. That is something that you can trust.
That is 100%. There's so... At last count, there's a historian who wrote a recent book on, I don't know, maybe 10, 15 years ago, on the various Roman republics.
This is the Harriet Flower book. It's great.
Exactly. Yeah.
People read it.
It's a fantastic book. And she argues that there were no fewer than 11 different sets of constitutional arrangements, like 11 different republican institutional and political regimes between 500 BC and Augustus.
I am, by the way, the guy who knows nothing about Rome whatsoever. So I might occasionally be asking open questions if that's okay.
Please do. Sure.
Were these constitutionally delineated, the roles here? Was it just kind of like a handshake agreement or?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. Yes and no. That's a really, really annoying answer. There was a Roman law code which is incorrectly described as a Roman constitution. Mm-hmm. So it was so the constitutional arrangements, the bureaucratic arrangements, and the political arrangements were based on a kind of mixture of legal and political precedent and written record keeping. So everyone knew how things were done. And there was a very kind of, and there was a sort of very sort of set and fixed way of doing things. And there were like dispensations. There were like extraordinary circumstances. Like, so whenever you see a TV program or a film about Julius Caesar, they get very, very fixated on the, oh, he was a dictator. He was a dictator. But the office of dictator was a completely legitimate political position. It was a short-term political position during all periods of the Roman Republic, where they would just put one guy in charge and be like, you have to sort out this particular like disaster, this like particular catastrophe. They're a kind of onboarding guy. They're a management consultant. They're a guy that gets like kind of brought in to like slice things up and like put things back together.
Maximus Kinsey, is this anything?
Yeah, Maximus Kinsey. Fine. Yeah, no. I'm into it. So the idea that there would be any nostalgia for the constitutional arrangements of the Republic is it's 10 years after everything was kind of fully dismantled in favor of all the kind of power being concentrated in the figure of one man at the time, the princeps, they were not called the emperor for a long while after, they were not called imperator for a while. That's pretty dubious. But also, first of all, what Marcus Aurelius is describing, he's not describing the Republic. He's describing leaving a military dictator in charge, for one thing, which is really not that much better. He's not saying, I want to like restore like voting rights to, like the People's Assembly, and they're going to choose the consuls. Like, that's not something that he's like come up with.
What the people need is Juche.
Marcus Aurelius has no interest in the ancient bureaucratic doings of his own people. Marcus Aurelius's big nostalgia fest was for the Greeks. He's a philosopher king. He's not really particularly interested in his own history. And also, up until this point, this idea that like, oh, we've had these emperors and they have these god awful sons, and like the entire fate of the empire is completely concentrated on whether or not some guy's son is a piece of shit or not. And again, simply not true. Augustus, who is the first emperor, was succeeded by his stepson, who was like the last person. He didn't want to hand it over to his stepson, but he did literally just choose him. He did just nominate a successor. And lots of emperors before Marcus Aurelius just nominated a successor. In fact, being succeeded by your son, pretty rare. It's actually not something that's like a kind of significant aspect of Roman history. And
ever
so
since
what...
I freed you from that dryer, Maximus, you're like a stepson.
Precisely.
Yeah.
So this is fundamentally anachronistic, is what you're telling me. Like, this whole setup is kind of goofy.
It's not just anachronistic. What it is is odd. Mm-hmm. Because if they had Marcus Aurelius saying, I want to return Rome to the time of Augustus, that this is the time when we were a wonderful kind of diplomatic force in the Mediterranean. We didn't just go around, you know, like, you know, fucking things up, you know, like, we built it out of marble, found it of brick, etc. So he's not saying that. He says, I want to restore the Republic, something that Marcus Aurelius never would have had any remote interest in. And then he describes something which is not the Republic at all. And then, like, right at the end, when Maximus is like, oh, yeah, like, I'm going to take over, but then I'm going to give it back to the people. And again, we're a little bit like low on the details. And it would have worked absolutely fine, if you ask me. First of all, it would have worked if the Spaniard did indeed have a catchphrase, because I want to hear a fucking catchphrase. In my head, he says it every time he shows up. So when he doesn't say it, I'm like literally just like there, just being like, say the line. You forgot to say. Are you not entertained?
Get all of it on a business card.
Yeah, that's really the problem.
That's not the line.
It is kind of like a mini CV though. His little speech.
It is. Yeah. Like it's. It's kind of cute that way.
Yeah, Pat, do you want to weigh in on these questions of Roman history?
Yeah. Okay. So nobody in the Roman world in 180 BC was especially nostalgic for quote unquote the Republic as a period of history, except maybe the senatorial aristocracy of Rome itself, who are like, I remember a time when we got to make decisions and do things. Those would be the only ones. The Roman people had not played any meaningful role in political processes for 200 years by this point. They had not done shit in terms of exercising votes or like putting it, like really having a voice in the political process at all. It's not clear that they would have wanted to at that point. But here's the other piece. This is my own pedantic thing that I found so annoying about this is Romans never stopped talking about res publica. They did not use that term to delineate a particular period of history. The res publica was just the common business, which we kind of shorthand for the state or the commonwealth of the Roman of the Romans. Romans were talking about that until the fucking fall of Byzantium, until the fall of Constantinople in 1453. The idea that there was still a Roman res publica existed. It's not like that was a thing that stopped when Octavian became Augustus. Like, so even in the most fundamental terms, this idea doesn't make sense. So the way I get around that when I'm watching this movie is by pretending that that doesn't happen and that that's not a plot point. Okay. And
I think the other thing you can do is just sort of transpose it and realize that this isn't really talking about Rome at all.
Yeah. It's the late 90s. This is late 90s neoconservatism as a driving plot in a sword and sandals epic.
Which I think is so wild too, because then it's like, you know, it makes me just go back and think about where we were at that time, you know, the rise of the Project for the New American Century and, you know, Bill Kristol's whole fucking thing. And yeah, there is so much media from this period in American culture that is just about how do we be the benevolent empire that we were always meant to be?
Yep.
And the way that you accomplish that, I think, is through a lot of veneration of great individuals who carry on the mantle of the ideal in individual action, but also through violence.
Yes.
And that's the thing that I think is really noteworthy. That's the other big thing that jumped out at me about this movie is like, it is, of course, a very violent movie because it's the genre and it's a gladiator movie. He's got to kill a bunch of guys in order to get to the Caesar and, you know, fucking win or whatever. But we are also meant to be simultaneously like repulsed by the violence, but also attracted to it. Mm-hmm. It never really seems to be able to land on one side or the other in terms of should we admire his violent action or is it merely a means to an end? And it feels like it wants to be both at the same time.
So I actually
the only thing that can stop a bad guy with a gladius.
So I actually disagree a little bit. I don't think it's ambivalent at all. I think it's 100% on the side of you need a good guy with a sword.
Okay. Yes, but I think the reason that I say ambivalence is that there are so many times where Russell Crowe will have these moments where it's like he's got the opportunity to finish the kill on the guy, right? And then he's got his big fucking halberd, and it's like, is he gonna do it? Is he not gonna do it? Oh, he didn't do it because there's something about like the idea, the concept of mercy, maybe, in that a kill is only moral if you are forced to do it by like if it's kill or be killed. But in a situation where somebody no longer poses an immediate credible threat, it is immoral to kill, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, that's very
Roman though.
There's this deep-seated thing about kind of the cleansing power of violence in Ridley Scott movies, and you can because it, which is very much of a piece. If you look at the movie that he made after this, which is Black Hawk Down, very similar kind of themes and views toward violence. But I was struck by what you were saying about kind of the focus on the great men of that time, and when you put it in those terms, it reminded me of Saving Private Ryan, which came out about two years before this, but was very much on everybody's mind. Band of Brothers too, which comes out a little bit after Gladiator does. And in all of those, there's this really kind of deep-seated idea that it's okay to be a good guy who kills people in service of a good cause. And which is, you know, you don't have to work that hard to understand how that widespread cultural belief gets you into the war on terror and invading Iraq and all of the other god-awful stuff that goes along with that. Like, it's an easy jump to see how the animating principles behind Gladiator get you there.
Yeah, I mean, you're priming the pump for state violence, right? And it's hard to say to what extent that is an intentional project of propaganda, but it's definitely propaganda.
Yeah.
Imagine how betrayed Saddam Hussein felt in 2003 when he loved the movie Gladiator. He was like, I also have two idiot sons. Yeah. This is great.
It's only true art if you can recognize yourself in it.
That's right. I relate to this. Who do you pass on absolute power to?
Yeah.
I love the idea of every single like monster and like despot of like the late 90s and early aughts, like West and East, all being under the impression that they are represented by Russell Crowe.
this has become a real movie for like reactionary dipshits too, hasn't it?
Karl Rove and Gaddafi think that they're the Spaniard.
Because when I think of like your fucking standard issue Pepe, I feel like this is a movie that a lot of those guys like, right?
Absolutely, because they love the cleansing power of violence,
right?
As a kind of an ideological thing, but B, because this is also a very to the point that was brought up earlier, it's a dude's rock movie.
Yeah, and they want to envision themselves as the guy. They in their own minds are Maximus, every single one of them.
Yeah, this is a movie that
has rock, you must first be the dude.
So true.
Yeah, this movie has a very positive understanding of masculinity and the connection and how inherent to masculinity violence is. Like again, true of pretty much all Ridley Scott movies. Like that all of his movies, pretty much all of his movies, with the exception of Alien, I guess.
Which is about femininity, actually.
Yeah, that's an interesting conversation to have. In all of those movies, though, there's this deep-seated belief or questioning of man's capacity for violence and whether that's good or bad. Like, The Last Duel, my favorite recent Ridley Scott movie, comes down entirely on the side of men doing violence leads to terrible things for everybody involved, right? But it is asking the question about what men doing violence does to the world around it. That's one of Scott's kind of central concerns in everything that he makes. And in this movie, he's very positive about it. He's 100% sure that men doing violence can do good things for society as a whole.
I'm not even sure I like completely agree with the idea that this is a very specifically American and neoconservative way of conceiving of violence, because I agree to an extent, but it's not like it's not ideologically distinct, because philosophically there was a pretty similar approach to violence in the Soviet Union, mm-hmm. and it can't be like kind of put down to a
Yeltsin was watching this. He's like, I'm in charge of a large country. I also have idiot son.
but it's a bit different though, isn't it? I mean, when you're talking about like the ideal of the, I don't know, I am no expert in the Soviet Union, to be clear, but the idea, I think, of sort of service to the motherland in the Soviet sense is that you are not just doing this for your country, sort of in the abstract sense, like being the individual agent of your country's narrative. You are also doing it with and alongside your comrades. I feel that it's always in the Soviet sort of monomyth, it's this idea that all of us, by coming together here, we can be the tip of the spear and, you know, win in the same way that we defeated the Germans at Stalingrad, right?
I think that's like, but that's like something which is made explicit in this as well. There's a bit where he literally says to the other gladiators who've also been forced into the situation, if we work together, we can survive.
Sure, but he is.
And at the end, he puts himself, he puts himself like kind of, you know, almost to the sword in order to save his men, to save his brothers in arms. Like there's a lot of comrading in service of the dream of Rome in like Roman martial philosophy.
But I don't think that's the thing though. I'm not sure that I agree that it's actually in service of Rome, the abstract idea. I think that it's in service of Maximus's idea of Rome, because Maximus in this conception of reality is sort of the primary acting moral agent. He's the guy who gets shit done, and that is so fundamentally American.
Because no dude can rock without other dudes.
Right.
That's true.
You cannot rock solo. That's what's called the tragedy of Springsteen.
That's it. Every Maximus needs his Jimon Honsu, and every Maverick needs his Goose, and so on and so.
And that's why John Wick is an entirely different kind of movie. John Wick is an action movie for an atomized society, and somehow in Ridley Scott's movies, there's a much more, I think, interesting question about how violence is embedded in social relationships, and that part of being a dude is coming together with other dudes to do violence. That is part of Scott's conception of manhood, is that violence is intrinsic to being a man, and how you deal with that, the purposes to which you put that is like, and Phoebe, I think you're 100% right that it's not specific to the United States, but I think given everything else that was happening around that time, those concepts were given more purchase and larger ramifications in an American context.
Absolutely. And obviously it's like significant that the film was made in this context. I'm just saying that this idea of organized violence in service of an abstract concept is simply not American.
what is unique is the focusing, like I said, on that individual. And I think that this is further made apparent at the end of the movie, where, you know, Maximus sort of gets his big moment of glorious death, but you don't really ever find out what happens to anybody else.
Until Gladiator 2, baby.
Well, okay. But at the end of the day, this is fundamentally his story and no one else's. I would argue.
Well, yeah, apart from you just getting the little bit of Jimon Honsu at the end, burying his little family voodoo dolls.
Right. Yeah.
But
that's not
the
like
the dudes left behind to rock alone.
They must now rock solo.
Hail Caesar, those about to rock salute you.
Yeah.
That's I want an AC/DC real missed opportunity to not have AC/DC do the theme song to this movie.
Absolutely.
Also, can we just talk for one hot second about how the theme song for Gladiator is exactly the same as the theme song for Pirates of the Caribbean?
Okay, No. It's so funny, Josh. I made this precise note, which was like a query about whether or not there was like a kind of bundle of film music in the early aughts that
it's just the same guy.
It's Hans Zimmer. And
specifically, it's fucking what's his name, the guy who composes all of Hans Zimmer's like songs. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hans Zimmer, who got the keys to my Bimmer.
Yeah. There we go. While we're on the subject of dudes rocking, I feel like I would be remiss if I did not bring up the character Proximo in this movie, the gladiator,
the rockinest of rocking dudes.
Yeah,
is that the really big guy?
The old man Oliver Reed, who's like the gladiator like trainer/owner.
Oh, that guy.
So Oliver Reed, apparently notoriously horrible to work with, like a complete nightmare. But he died during the filming of Gladiator.
Wow.
I think they had to like CGI him in for some scene at the end that he hadn't shot yet or something.
That's why his death scene is him getting stabbed from the back.
The way they frame it, though. I really like that shot.
That's the difference between Ridley Scott and some random person that you got to do an episode of Those About to Die. Ridley Scott gives us a satisfying faceless death. And the imitators do not. Mm.
Shadows and dust, Maximus.
So Oliver Reed, they were shooting Gladiator in Malta, I presume for some kind of tax credit or because they simply love like British imperial relics in the Mediterranean.
I think probably what happened was Oliver Reed committed like a series of public order offences in Malta and was not allowed to leave. So they just had to up sticks and just move filming operations to there.
Yeah, possibly. Well, this does tie in with the rest of the story. So, but there was a British naval ship moored in Malta, which there often is. And Oliver Reed somehow during the filming of Gladiator got involved in a drinking and arm wrestling contest.
I've heard about this. Yes.
With yeah, sailors? With the sailors. And he drank some ungodly amount of alcohol and was arm wrestling one of them when he collapsed of a heart attack and died shortly before the end of filming.
Okay. First of all, that fucking rules. I mean,
dude's
I feel
rock.
Like it does. What a way to go. That's like you get to go to like dude Valhalla.
Absolutely.
If you die in that fashion.
I mean, that's basically how I want to die now. I don't know how else to put this, but that's the
we're putting that on Patrick's vision board, the Pinterest boards for ways I would like to be killed.
Put it on your epitaph too. He rocked too hard.
Yeah. I want to die with a real crispy tan just like that. Like,
oh
yeah,
my god!
How good is his tan? I mean,
he's fully like roasted, roasted to a bronze sheen. It's extraordinary.
You don't really see that.
True Brit in the sun.
You don't see that enough anymore.
No,
that's a real the spray tans have taken that from us.
If the heart attack hadn't gotten him, the melanoma would have. You know,
that's true. Yeah, that's true. So
his headstone really should have like a flat portion for arm wrestling. And then like some cup holders so that you can go at it.
I have trained at multiple gyms that have professional arm wrestling tables. It's awesome. It's so cool. Like there's nothing better than just grabbing a hold of that handle and really getting in there.
It's such a bizarre discipline, arm wrestling, because it sort of tests nothing.
it's solely the strength of your bicep, your biceps
tests
tendons, and your rotator.
Nothing. It determines who's the biggest boy.
I was gonna say,
Oh, yeah, Milo. I forgot about that.
This is like nothing. Next thing you know, Milo will be putting down all forms of meaningless male competition.
Yeah, come
this
on.
Buddy, there's no purpose to any of it. It's all a status contest.
So I guess you hate the dick measuring ruler in the toilet.
That reminds me, I like that one too.
That's what I'm saying.
I feel like Milo, you specifically will appreciate this. I was at a bar a couple weeks ago, back home in New York, and went to the bathroom, and there was this guy next to me at the urinals, this Irish guy who was like blackout drunk. And he just started looking at my dick and complimenting it, but like not in a gay way.
Just
it was like he was just like so impressed. He was like, "Wow, that's a fantastic dick you got there." I don't know why what the voice is that I'm doing right now. But it was a dude's rock moment,
yeah,
you know,
beautiful.
Where he just really wanted me to know. But this is the thing that you're gonna love is the last thing he said was like, "You're not a Trump supporter." I was like, "Hell no." And he's like, "Yeah, I knew that. Not with a cock like that."
Phoebe looked directly into the camera at that moment. That was perfect.
Yeah, this has been said before, and it's worth saying again, that there is nothing gayer than a straight man. Like, not a single thing. The straight dudes love being gay.
a great quote there. Now I have to tell this story that one time.
Have you also had your penis complimented in a bathroom?
No, not my penis. I was present at the complimenting of another man's penis.
Oh, okay. it sounds like a ceremony.
I was at a sex party this one time, and me and my girlfriend were chatting. We're chatting to this guy. Who's bisexual. And I think at first we thought he was chatting her up, but I think later it became clear that he was chatting me up. But then he breaks off mid-conversation with me and like looks over at some guy who's like sat on a bench over in the corner of the room, who's like, he's like about to fuck this chick. And then he goes like, "That guy's got a really nice cock." And I'm like, "I guess so." It was sort of such an odd, like, he said it in the manner of someone talking about the weather, you know?
Right,
I remember like, "Yep, lovely day for it." And then he goes, "I'm going to go over there and tell him." And before I could like intervene in this, he'd gone over there. But they were too far away for me to hear what they were saying, which actually made it way funny. Well, yeah, because I saw him kind of like gesture at the guy's cock.
Uh-huh.
And then I saw them shake hands. Just came back over.
That was basically the vibe of this conversation. Was like, it felt like he was expecting a handshake or something.
Yeah. Also, the rest of us are all dressed apart from the guy who's cocky. You can
see. So good.
Yeah.
That's rock.
Wow. God, Phoebe, if you're ever wondering whether it is in fact awesome to be a dude, this is one of those times when the answer is yes.
Oh, yeah, no. Yeah. That's definitely what I was wondering. What you doing? What's the etiquette here? Like, is it correct to wash your hands before shaking, or do you assume that they want you not to have washed your hands?
Oh, I mean,
oh yeah.
I think that's a game time decision.
Okay. Yeah, you gotta read the room, check the vibes before you go in or don't.
How much dick observation and admiring do you think went on in the gladiatorial school?
Oh, so much?
A lot.
Probably a lot. I love Oliver Reed in this film because I love the idea of gladiating as like a kind of traveling Amdram thing. And he's we finally get to go back to Rome. I love the idea of like a retired gladiator now running a gladiator school. It's like being like a retired ballet dancer who now like teaches 4-year-olds and is like looking for like the next what's she called?
It's like Panto. You truly do it on the way up and the way down.
Yeah.
I'm just really sad that there isn't more actual homoeroticism in this movie. Like, this is unfortunately a very straight movie.
I mean, there's no eroticism.
No. Which is a shame. Yeah.
Like even the incest stuff, not saying that that would be erotic, but more like that's what we got.
They've gone out of their way to make it not
like what we've got in this film, like female characters, you know, such as they are, we have a conniving MILF. We always have to have the conniving MILF. It's Rome after all.
That's right.
It is, yeah.
And we have a silent dead woman. We have the Nolan special. And what we have is we have two.
We have a feminine son.
Call me Andrea Dworkin if you must. I don't think a boy with a girl's haircut counts as a female character in Gladiator.
I'm just saying by the standards of this
standards
film,
of this film
probably
fine.
Does.
It does very specifically get set up as demonstrating two modes of engaging with romantic love. We have this entirely chaste, entirely silent romantic love that the gladiator has for his dead wife, and we have the sordid, disgusting, distorted love that Commodus has for his sister. So that's what the two women in this film like exist to embody. One sort of chatly and one silently. But the mistake that the Spaniard makes before returning home. Before, you know, his last day in army before he retires. The mistake he makes is that whenever he starts thinking about his wife and son, he thinks about them in slow motion.
Yeah.
And he puts the music. You can't, if you're going to be thinking sentimentally about home, you've got to think about them to the Benny Hill soundtrack, say.
Mm. Yeah, no, this is a classic mistake.
You've got to have them in high color.
Chasing each other around.
Full
body movement. As soon as you've got the fucking wind kind of moving her tunic around in a sort of...
Oh, you know she's fucking done.
That wife is as dead as any wife has ever been.
Yeah, that's like... And the thing is that, again, we have this opposite because we have the Emperor Commodus and he's got his fucking... heat tech thermal polar neck that he wears under his armor.
Yeah.
And so
he's been to Uniqlo.
He's been to Uniqlo. Mm-hmm. He's done a big stock up because it's December.
It's a really sensible blue. Really good for the winter season.
He's looking really sensible. He's looking really looking really nice and warm. Nobody is picturing him with the wind kind of, you know, blowing through the wheat. No one's putting music. No.
He's never been imagined with the establishing music for a shot of like Baghdad.
I found the costumes in this movie to be hit or miss. Can I just say that? I think that some of them were cool. And like the way that they sort of had the big, like Roman soldiers with the black, like all black, whatever, was kind of striking. The way that they dressed up, I guess the Joaquin Phoenix, his looks were mostly pretty on point. I felt that the MILF, they didn't make a strong choice for her. I felt, I didn't get a strong sense of the costuming reflecting anything about the character's inner lived experience. But then again, there isn't much of a character there to reflect. So I get it.
You don't really buy her as a MILF, a hot aunt.
No,
a hot aunt, maybe. But not a MILF.
Right.
Okay. This is, look, we have spent an inordinate amount of time over the past several years discussing the archetypes of conniving MILF and honorable matron. And this movie really takes those two to not the extreme, but pretty close, in the sense that the honorable matron literally has no lines and is the longest shot of her is her crucified hanging feet. That's right. The a real
fully purple those feet.
Yeah, real honorable matron hours right there.
Yeah.
This movie really goes hard on that dichotomy.
Mm. Mm. And it's like honestly, like I think all that stuff. I just think it's a bit much. It's just horrible. It's really unnecessarily horrible.
What, the crucifying his wife and kid? That bit?
Yeah, I don't care for it.
They would have been like, this is a bit much. What are we Serbian? What are we doing this for?
It really was. I had that reaction to that moment as well, too, where it's like, okay, like we get it. Like we get it. Those guys are evil. Like there is a slight problem with this movie where the evil guys are so evil and there isn't even so much of a good reason for them to be that evil. I think Joaquin Phoenix gets around it by giving such a good performance that's so grounded in insecurity, but the writing doesn't support it. I think
you're right to an extent. I think it's like, I think the stuff where like Commodus gets really fixated on whether or not he seems merciful, I think it's quite fun. I think it's like quite a kind of fun bit of exploration, particularly when he has the opportunity to have Maximus done in, like in front of everyone. And he's like, no, I can't do it because everyone will think I'm not merciful. But I think this is a little bit undermined by the Jason Statham in the Transporter style bit when the gladiator single-handedly defeats like 10 guys. And then there's a sound effect like when he like puts his sword back away. And I feel like,
well, that's just the noise. That's the noise that the sword made.
No, it's not.
that was.
Yeah, that wasn't.
It's a sound effect. It's like,
No, it was real. I was there.
No. I rewound it several times. It is definitely disconnected with the actual, with the
no,
motion.
It's cool.
Of the, with
it's
the,
cool and it's real and it's
with
my
the,
friend.
With the motion of the sword.
Yeah.
And it, like,
well, because the whole movie is a vehicle for like the epic bits when he says
the frost sometimes make the blade
stick. Yeah.
Or are you not entertained?
Or what, you know, it's a vehicle for these lines. That's what it's really about. You kill a guy, you say a thing, and everyone then talks about it years later when they're stoned.
Everybody in the crowd just sits back and goes, okay, now that was epic. Yeah. Like that's just kind of the
That's the register that you have to approach this movie through to really get to really squeeze it for what it's worth. Like if you try to treat this as a serious exploration of Roman history, a serious exploration of themes of democracy or whatever, it's not that. It is schlock that has been massively elevated by a couple of performances. Like, I don't even think the script is that good.
No.
Like and as it turns out, a lot of the really iconic scenes in this movie, like Maximus with his wife's feet, which is like a super, it's a super well-known scene. It's one of the most poignant bits of the movie. That's not how that was supposed to go. And
couldn't
Ridley's,
do that now, not with the feet, guys.
Wicked feet would go crazy for that. But that scene, Russell Crowe redid that like a bunch of times to get the right amount of pathos into it, which was not what Ridley Scott wanted from him.
Oh, interesting.
That was not how that scene was supposed to go. I think that's probably also true of a lot of the scenes with Joaquin Phoenix, that they really elevated what was not supposed to be anywhere near this good.
I'm just imagining Ridley Scott during that scene leaning back in the chair and being like, all right, now let's do a silly one.
Well, so the
Russell, you're still doing it Australian. Can you stop doing the accent, please?
So they had multiple conversations about how they were going to do the accents, and apparently they did shoot some of it with him trying to do a kind of a vaguely Roman accent, and then they ditched that. That's and just funny. Had him go back to do it at normal.
Yeah.
There was, I did notice one take ended up in the final assembly of the big fight scene at the beginning between the Romans and the vile Huns, where there it was just fully an outtake shot. Like, you could see people like smiling, and like there was a guy patting each other on the back. It was like, that, hold on, what's that doing in there? They're supposed to be fighting right now. I don't know how that ended up in the final cut, but it tickled me.
Yeah. Well.
So
wait.
So I've got like I've got like one or two like stray notes to cover. One of them is just a sort of general observation about the stronghold of Germania remaining, and I don't even think that's true. I don't think that's right. But I've put that I think that Russell Crowe choked on some water before they started filming the first scene, and so he started really kind of like gravelly, and then just had to keep it up for the whole film. We've got the point about the reusing the music. There's an objection to there being a German shepherd dog. I'm not that happy about there being the Alsatian there. Why is there an Alsatian? I've written down something that Oliver Reed says, which is I'm not going to include the context because I don't want to. You sold me queer giraffes. I want my money back.
Great line.
Yeah.
While squeezing the guy's balls.
Yep. Then I've also got here.
Isn't that delivered to Omid Jalili? Okay, someone we bring up a lot on this podcast.
So, Milo, you'd be delighted to hear that the next note after the queer giraffes one is literally, oh, is this why Milo keeps bringing up Omid Jalili? I thought it was just because he likes him.
I do also like
why not
him.
Both?
I just think every movie would be improved by a little bit of Omid Jalili.
Yeah, there are some actors who are just like that, where they show up and you're like, this movie just got 10% better. Let's go.
I've got a comment on If We Work Together, We'll Survive. Because I've put that I love that the moral of this is the same as the moral of children's TV. And then I've put there's one ship they can never sink in a theatrical replay of the Bay of Salamis in the Colosseum, and that's a friendship.
Yeah, that's right.
Thank you, Pat. I'm glad you liked it. Then I've just put that just like as the film goes on, as like Com just gets like more and more like annoyed, like particularly when he does the line, I was like, oh, he's gonna say it, fucking hell. And Com is like, oh shit, that's not ideal. Like, I've got to say that's a good line. Then I have a bit about Maximus practicing it in the mirror and getting it wrong several times before he really got it down.
There's nobody else here, so you must.
As he gets more and more evil, it looks more and more like he has a nasty cold. And then when Maximus gets put on like the torture device, he sort of says like, oh yeah, you've been afraid all your life, which is a very funny thing to say to somebody who has strapped you to a torture device, because like he doesn't care. Like, I know he's very easily rattled, this Commodus, but at that point, he's a bit like, I feel like I've got the upper hand here. I don't feel like you have any power in this situation.
R.I.P. Emperor Commodus. You would have loved Twitter.com. Place where you can be easily rattled every single day of your life.
Like, well, this is like, I mean, surely that is like that's now like the kind of motto of Twitter.com. It is, am I not merciful? They think I'm not merciful. They're acting like I'm not merciful when everyone knows I'm the most merciful and have the coziest neck.
We've got to bring peace to Germania by defeating their evil leader, Grok.
And so I think probably this is about as good a place as any to wrap it up. Do we have any, does anyone have any final thoughts?
You know, it's fun. It's fun for what it is. And there
is, but like, why did they use, not just like Pirates of the Caribbean music, not like the Pirates of the Caribbean incidental music, the Pirates of the Caribbean music, which is specifically.
It's the same composer.
It's not that, it's the same, it's not just the same composer. It's not just like, oh, this sounds like his like style because this is just like, this is just his general vibe. This is literally the same music that gets used.
Same chord progression, same everything.
Same chord progression that gets used specifically to indicate boats.
Maybe the thought was, you know, Pirates of the Caribbean is kind of a kid's movie. Gladiator is not really a kid's movie. So who's going to know?
Pirates of the Caribbean didn't exist. This is pre-Pirates of the Caribbean. So if actually,
the crazy.
No, I know. Actually, so when I'm saying when he set out to make the music for Pirates of the Caribbean, he was like, okay.
Shall I just reuse the Gladiator music?
Exactly. I still got these synth patches lying around. That was a pretty cool chord progression. Let's run it back and do it again.
Yeah. Who could forget the bit in Gladiator where he says, we'll survive if we work together. And then it goes, bah!
Well, the first pitch is when he does something which sounds an awful lot like the Benny Hill music. He's like, look, I just feel like we could have used some levity in this movie.
Not a lot of levity here.
Yeah. Here's what I'll say. You know, it's a movie about, you know, dudes who rock, you know, brought together by, you know, organized violence. But was there not another group of dudes who were brought together by a rock and organized violence? The Tarpeian rock?
Aw. Boo.
No, nothing like that. Okay, fair enough.
I don't even know what that's a reference to.
I like
doing my best.
Is Commodus the conniving MILF of this film?
Yeah.
He might be, you know.
Fine.
Yeah.
I'll allow it.
Yeah.
So MILFs can be dudes too? Is that our sort of closing thought?
Josh, absolutely, yes.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Man, I'd love to fucking be a dude. With only a little bit of violence applied to the acronym.
It's close.
It remains us only to thank Josh for coming on.
Hey, thank you for having me on.
This was so much fun.
Yeah, this was fun. I, you know, spent 2.5 hours of my London trip. The thing is, the jet lag has been such a problem that, like, I have not been able to sleep a lot. So this was something to keep me occupied while I tried to sleep.
Perfect time to watch Gladiator.
Exactly. Yeah, so thank you for that opportunity. Thank you for this opportunity.
Is there anything you'd like to plug to the loyal hogs?
By all means, you may well know of my show at this point, but if you do not, or if you need a reminder, we do a show called The Worst of All Possible Worlds. Every week is a case study in the pop culture of a dying empire. In our case, of course, we usually talk about American Empire. But occasionally British Empire, and every once in a blue moon, the Japanese Empire. Our main interest is just on media narratives, how those media narratives shape the world that they live in, that we live in, and also how they parallel what was going on contemporaneously. So that back and forth that we were having, Pat, about sort of the way that Gladiator fits into the 90s mindset. That's the kind of shit we do on our show all the time. So if that is of interest to you, go check us out. Our website is worstpossible.world. And we also have a Patreon, which is patreon.com/worstofall.
We'll drop a link in the show notes. And if you're listening to this, thank you very much for being, I believe, a Patreon subscriber. So, yeah, thanks. Please continue doing that, where there will be more of this.
You got it.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, all right. Bye,
bye. Bye-bye.